News Talk 590 WVLK, and that means it's time for the 9 to 10 show. I'm Dave Kessling, sitting in for the vacationing Jack Patty. My guest this hour, Dr. Tom Kimmerer. We're going to be talking to him in just a moment, but first, I want to remind you that this portion of the show is brought to you by Landscaper's Corner at 1305 Old Frankfort Pike in Lexington. Landscaper's Corner has the largest selection of natural stone in the area. Call Landscaper's Corner at 225-9433. Also want to tell you about the question of the day. This is brought to you by United Structural Systems, your foundation repair and waterproofing experts. iFixFoundations.com at 859-254-7700. The question of the day is, which document is the most important to the U.S. in the 21st century? You can give us your opinion and register it at WVLKAM.com. Scott Johnson's going to have the results for you tomorrow morning right here on News Talk 590 WVLK. All right. 9 to 10 show, as I mentioned before, and we've got a very special guest in the studio, Dr. Tom Kimmerer. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. How are you today?
Excellent, excellent. Tom is a local author, been in the Lexington area for a long time, but he is a doctor of, I'm going to call it forest management, from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and you've got a whole line of specifiers on that doctorate, but that pretty much covers it, doesn't it?
Yes.
Excellent, excellent. You've written a book called Venerable Trees, History, Biology, and Conservation in the Bluegrass, and I'm guessing the very first question to ask is, what is a venerable tree?
Well, the thing that astonished me, I've lived in Lexington for almost 35 years, and the thing that has astonished me since I came here is the number of really huge, really old trees, either as individuals or in groves throughout the bluegrass.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time to realize and do a lot of research to realize that these are ancient pre-settlement trees. And we probably have, I won't say probably, we have the largest population of ancient trees that predate Kentucky, or predate the United States for that matter, in the bluegrass than in any settled area of North America. So you can go all the way out to California to see old trees, or you can just drive down the road here.
And it is amazing, because one of the examples in your book is that people sitting there driving every day up and down Harrodsburg Road are passing under an oak tree that not only is watching your automobile go by, but watched horses and buggies go by, and way back when watched the bison go by when they established the trail to begin with. So we're talking several hundred years, aren't we?
Yeah, we're talking a large population of trees that are probably 300 to 500 years old. You can't tell the age of a tree by looking at it, but we've been able to count rings on some trees, and we believe now that there are probably some that go back as far as 800 years.
And again, the one on Harrodsburg Road, it's right there at Red Mile Road almost, a little south of that.
That's one of the best ones to look at, because if you're stuck in traffic, it's right there. But that tree has been 8 feet from Harrodsburg Road since Harrodsburg Road was a buffalo trace.
Oh, that's unreal. That's unreal. So tell me about what is it that, and all of this in your book, I've got to tell you that the book is, I called it evocative, in that it brings up an awful lot of information, brings up an awful lot of thought patterns, and it's just intriguing how you get to some of this information. How did the bluegrass area get to be so blessed with these ancient trees?
Well, we have to go back to before people arrived here, before Europeans arrived here. There were vast herds of bison here. We think of bison as a Western animal, but there were huge populations of bison here, probably hundreds of thousands, individual herds of tens of thousands, wandering through the bluegrass, eating grass and cane, and creating this open landscape that didn't exist anywhere else. So when the first settlers came here, the reason that Lexington was settled is that they didn't have to clear forest in order to be able to farm here. A little piece of trivia here. Lexington is the only 17th century or 18th century city on this side of the mountains that's not on a river.
Oh, wow.
And that's because, you know, that's how you got around in the 18th century is by river. But when people arrived here, they said, we could farm here without very much effort. All they really had to do was drive the bison away, which took about 20 years, but they started right away, and move in first cattle and sheep, and later came the horses.
That's amazing. Now, the thing is a lot of the times when you think about the colonial days, you see in the movies like Leather Stocking Tales that the pioneers were sitting there going through the heavy bush and, you know, hacking through and no trails. But that wasn't the case here in the bluegrass. They found open pasture-like areas, right?
That's correct. I, working on the book, I went up to the University of Wisconsin, my alma mater, whose library has a huge archive of early and pre-settlement narratives where people were interviewed about their experience. And they were just astonished. They called this the land of milk and honey. They, you know, they spent months struggling through dense forests. And anywhere they wanted to establish a city or a town, they spent years clearing. And they got here and they found this open landscape that they could move into without doing much clearing. They had no incentive to cut down all the trees. A lot of them are gone now. But they had no incentive to cut down all the trees. And as a result, many of the trees that are shading our pastures now were shading that same landscape before Europeans arrived here to settle.
So now you're talking about not only are the bison or buffalo a key component to that, but another unique aspect is the karst topography, I should say, the basic geology of the area. How does that figure in?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. We're if you're in the bluegrass right now, you're standing or sitting on top of 6,000 feet of limestone. And the limestone is water soluble, so when it rains, some of the rock dissolves, and that creates this karst topography where we have sinkholes, caves, of course, which were famous for cracks and fissures in the rock. A lot of these trees became established during periods of severe drought, and they were able to do so by rooting not in the soil surface but deep down in the rock. The famous old schoolhouse oak across from the military pike on Harrodsburg Road that we take care of, we've done some analysis and some digging. And we found that even though the soils there are very deep and rich soils, that tree is not rooted in the soil. It's rooted way down below in the rock. And therefore, it has access to water year-round, even during drought.
Now, how long a root system are you talking about? How far down can these go, or can you even guess?
We don't know. There's been some analysis. Paul Kalas, who's a retired UK professor, did some analysis. And I believe, if I'm remembering right, that the maximum they found was about 230 feet down. There are oak roots that come through the roof of Mammoth Cave.
Wow.
So they can go pretty deep.
That's unreal. So we're talking about the components that generated this interesting and unique environment around here, the karst topography, the limestone down beneath us, the wandering buffalo in the area, and there was a third component to that, wasn't there, that helped this out?
Which one was that?
He's looking at me. To be honest with you, it's the occasional appearance of fire. Fire has a real component in
this. This is a really important thing you bring up, because it turns out that this bluegrass, we call it the woodland pasture habitat, never had fire.
Oh.
And this is what some people call it savanna, but savanna ecosystems in North America are fire ecosystems. So the savannas of Wisconsin and Illinois and Ohio, the Prairie Peninsula in the Midwest, those were created in part by fire, much of which was started by Indians. We find absolutely no evidence that fire ever played a role in this ecosystem. In fact, we've never found charcoal in the soil, and we never find fire scars in the trees that we take down.
Wow.
This was created by bison, and what's interesting is this ecosystem occurs here in the bluegrass and in the Nashville Basin, nowhere else in North America. But it does occur in England. It's in England, Scotland, Russia, Romania, Spain, France. They all have woodland pasture ecosystems that were started the same way by European bison.
So we're talking an area of just several, very few central Kentucky counties that have this amazing, unique ecosystem.
That's absolutely correct. It's completely rare, yeah.
And the Indians knew about this. Apparently the Indians had a large settlement over in, is it Clark County?
Yep, it's called Skippakithiki. Say that three times.
No, thank you. I'll let you do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, this is an important thing to understand, is that there were no permanent Indian settlements in the Bluegrass. And I'm not talking about just going back to the Shawnee pre-settlement, but going back thousands of years to the archaic Indians. We believe that it's because they could not compete with the bison. You can imagine, you don't have a horse and you don't have a rifle, and thousands of bison come over the hill and walk through your village. Mm-hmm. And flatten it. And this happened to several early settlers that built cabins and had them flattened.
Well, I'm thinking of that one scene in the motion picture, How the West Was Won, where they have the bison stampede.
Yeah.
And there's not really any way you can sit there and withstand that. Structures can't withstand it. And if you're a simple human being, you're going to get nailed.
And Western Indians had topography. They could live on tops of bluffs. They could drive bison off the bluffs. They didn't have that advantage here. Mm. Now, we do know that Indians, and before settlement, long hunters, hunted here in the winter because the bison would leave. The bison were up on the rivers mm-hmm. where they could get water during the winter. And so we find definite signs of Indian hunting camps. I'm working on a project in Jessamine County where there's clear signs that Indians, not Shawnee, but 3,000 years ago, Indians were sitting there making arrow and spear points while they hunted elk and deer. Well, the bison, wow. bison were gone, but they weren't here in the summer.
Amazing. Tell you what, we're going to be back, and we're going to talk about a little more specifically the trees themselves that make up the venerable trees. With Dr. Tom Kimmerer, who is the author of Venerables. Time right now, 9:22, News Talk 590 WVLK. Real quickly, we have a salute to those who have served, a special program today at noon right here on News Talk 590 WVLK. Don't miss that. Dr. Tom Kimmerer, the author of Venerable Trees, the History, Biology, and Conservation in the Bluegrass, is my guest here in the studio. And we talked a little bit about the unique conditions here in the Bluegrass, but let's get right down to it. When we talk about venerable trees, what particular kinds of trees are we talking about?
Well, there are about, say, around 50 tree species that are native to the Bluegrass.
Okay.
Most of them, though, are not really long-lived. So hackberry, which is the most abundant tree in the Bluegrass, most hackberries probably live maybe 100 years, 150 years or so. But there's a group of five species that make up the trees of the woodland pastures that we've determined are long-lived enough that as individuals they were here before settlement. And those five species are bur oak, which most people would recognize, chinkapin oak, shumard oak, so there's three oak trees, blue ash, and then a hickory that we call kingnut. Some people call it shellbark hickory, but the original name was kingnut for its tennis ball size.
Oh, wow.
Fruits that are really highly edible. I mean, the pioneers for their pigs and themselves really valued kingnut, so we call it kingnut. So these are trees that we know can live for the hundreds of years that it takes to form these woodland pastures.
Mm-hmm. But again, as you mentioned in your book, they have a long lifespan, but they've also got a real long gestation period. You're talking about a tree that's 18 inches tall that's 20 years old, right?
Yeah, they're not very fast growing. You know, under the proper conditions, they can grow faster than we might think they can. But, always a trade-off. Fast-growing trees don't live very long.
Okay.
Slow-growing trees live longer.
So kind of the problem with this thing is you've got to have a little bit of protection. You talk about this in the book. An important component of this, and we can use the term ecology properly here, in that you have interrelationships between all of these different living species. Part of the reason we have some of these venerable 400-year-old trees, is because of the bison and other conditions like that.
That's correct. The bison would feed heavily. They're grazers. They're not browsers. They only eat grass and cane. Cane was which is our bamboo. It was very abundant here. They would graze down an area, churn up the soil, but they would leave sometimes for decades at a time in search of better forage or water or salt. And that would give time for these trees to get established and start growing and be large enough by the time the bison came back that they would survive. So this is a very much a bison-created ecosystem. When the first settlers came and drove off the bison, they moved in their cattle and sheep, and there were probably reasonable conditions for these trees to keep reproducing. We know that some of the blue ash trees really date as late as 1900 or the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. But everything came to a halt around 1936, and that's the date of the release, widespread release of the Farmall tractor and the invention of the bush hog. And so now what happens is every farm you look at, it's either being heavily grazed or it's being grazed and mowed. And so there's basically no niche. You know, in ecology, we talk about a niche, a place where an organism can live. There's really no niche for these trees to reproduce. So in the vast majority of the woodland pastures that we have looked at throughout the bluegrass of the Nashville Basin, we find basically these trees aren't reproducing at all, which means another 100 years, the woodland pastures will be gone.
Unless we do something about it. I was telling you off the air, I've been to the highlands of Scotland. They used to have the Caledonian Forest up there, a primordial forest that appeared after the retreat of the glaciers, but it was all cleared by the landowners up there, and it's just tragic to see what had been forest, heavy forest, totally wiped out.
That's absolutely true. Basically, northern Europe was completely denuded of forest, except in Germany, and certainly in the British Isles, there was nothing left. I mean, the Royal Navy was having to go all the way to the Baltic Sea to get wood before the settlement of North America.
Well, in fact, wasn't that one of the motivations for the British was down in Georgia, the naval stores?
Well, I'll tell you a quick little story about it.
Okay.
So in 1605, a British sailor named George Weymouth was sent on an expedition to go down the coast of Maine and look for places to settle. This was before any settlements except St. Augustine in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing he found was these giant trees that we now call eastern white pine. And he knew right away that he had found something extremely valuable because the Royal Navy was the largest, most powerful navy in the world. They needed giant trees to make masts. And so as soon as the coast started getting settled, the first industry was logging white pine, and the first export commodity was exporting masts. And then they even started to run out of those, and the King of England said, well, look, these white pine trees are mine. And he sent surveyors around to emblazon the white pine trees with the king's broad arrow, which was three axe cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And on penalty of at least fining, if not prison, the colonists didn't dare cut these down.
Wow.
Well, after a while, the colonists said, we're not taking any of this. And they started cutting the trees down and hiding them and doing all sorts of things. This was, and I think people in this part of the country don't realize, but people in Maine certainly know, this was a major driving force behind the American Revolution. A lot of the first flags in New England had white pines on them. There's a famous flag that now became the Vermont state flag, still to this day, is white pine.
Mm-hmm.
So here on Independence Day, we can celebrate the importance of white pine in fomenting revolution.
Okay, so we've got a little tree relation there. Tell you what, our phone lines are open. You can give us a shout. 253-5959. Touchstar 590 from AT&T or toll free from anywhere. 1-877-777-0590. Dr. Tom Kimmerer, if you've got any questions for him, the author of Venerable Trees, is going to be on the line. And we're going to be back and talk about one of the earliest and most impressive arboretums in the world, but it didn't start out as an arboretum. News Talk 590 WVLK, 935 on a Monday morning. You're in tune with the 9 to 10 show. My name's Dave Kessling, sitting in for Jack Patty. My special guest this hour is Dr. Tom Kimmerer, the author of the book Venerable Trees, the History, Biology, and Conservation in the Bluegrass. And I've got to tell you, I highly recommend it because it's an awful lot of information compressed into a little bitty book that won't really take you that long to read. It's definitely a worthwhile recommendation. I wanted to ask you real quickly before we take a phone call. We've got some folks on the line here we'll get to, but we have got really something I didn't realize. I mean, I was familiar with it, but not until I read your book did I realize that we've got one of the country's oldest arboretums in town, but it also happens to be one of the most celebrated, even to this day, natural arboretums, and that is?
Lexington Cemetery.
Tell me all about it.
Fantastic place. Lexington Cemetery was founded in 1849 by a group of Lexington business people, and it was right at the beginning of a movement in which cemeteries went from being simply places where you buried people to places where you buried people in beautiful environments, and families went on weekends to visit. And there were no parks in the city at the time, so Lexington Cemetery kind of became the park. And on a Sunday afternoon, it would be crowded with families picnicking and playing. What they did to establish a cemetery was to buy a piece of property called Boswell Woods, which was a woodland pasture plus. It was a little denser than a woodland pasture. They cleared as few trees as possible. And they kind of built the roads, the way the roads wander through the cemetery. Part of that works around these ancient trees. There are about 170 bur oaks in Lexington Cemetery. I've counted them. And at least 30 of those are pre-settlement, that they were there before the cemetery. And
so then, we're talking several hundred years old.
Yes, yes. And some of the largest in the state are there. And also the largest American basswood in the world is in Lexington Cemetery, right in front of Henry Clay's monument.
Kind of a century.
Yeah, you should go see that tree. It is unbelievable. And then what happened is the management of Lexington Cemetery realized that these beautiful trees were their signature, especially bur oak. So immediately after their founding, they began a planting program, and they've been planting ever since. They also do absolutely minimal maintenance. They use no herbicides, no pesticides.
What you make a great deal of emphasis on is that is kind of a villain in the venerable tree story.
Modern lawn care is fatal to large trees. There's just no question about it.
Why is that?
Well, first of all, you're using herbicides to get rid of things like clover. Well, those are broadleaf herbicides. So if they come in contact with the tree roots, they're going to stress the tree. It's probably not high enough concentration to outright kill them, but slowly over time, it stresses them. Fertilizer is even worse. It may seem counterintuitive to think that it's a bad idea to fertilize trees, but trees do not do well, especially with high amounts of nitrogen. They evolved in an environment in which nitrogen was very limiting and hard to get at. And so if you give them too much nitrogen, they put on sudden spurts of growth and often will die. And I've seen this in Lexington. And then the third part component of this is the heavy machinery that is used to mow landscapes now. And that combination is really bad. Well, it's bad for any tree.
Well, we had Laura, who didn't want to go on the air, but she was amazed to hear about the, advent of agricultural tractors actually contributing to the downfall of these trees. And you're saying it's the mechanical injury around the trunk of the tree. It's damaging the bark, allowing fungus to get in, right?
That's correct. In fact, I've inspected hundreds of woodland pastures on private land and farms throughout Kentucky and Nashville area, and it's very rare to find trees that are not being stressed by mower damage.
And it's not only the mower damage banging off the tree, it's soil compaction of the heavy equipment.
That's correct. And it's also, and here's the big thing, and the reason these trees aren't reproducing, it's that, if a little bur oak acorn gets established and the little seedling gets up to be a few inches tall and along comes the mower, there goes the tree.
And that's about a year's worth of growth on that tree.
On those young trees, yes.
Amazing. Tell you what, we got Hank on the line. Good morning, Hank. You're on the air with Dr. Kimmerer. Go ahead.
Good morning, guys. Dr. Kimmerer, I have three oak trees that you mentioned in my yard. And my question to you is this. What can the average, you've partially answered it, I think, but what can the average homeowner do to promote the health and longevity of the trees in his or her yard? And if you don't mind, I'm going to hang up and listen. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you for your call.
That's a great question, Hank, and it's perfectly timed in our conversation. And I did partially answer that. you need to take less care of your lawn.
Okay.
And, you know, if I see a big, beautiful bur oak in a front yard and the lawn around it is perfect of, you know, thick grass, the first thing I say to the property owner is, you got to change what you're doing. This is really bad for the tree. A lawn that has clover and some weeds and that the landowner is mowing him or herself with a fairly lightweight mower is what these trees need. Now, if you use a mulching mower, you don't need to fertilize. If you're able to leave a space around the tree that can be in mulch, and then in the fall, when the leaves fall on the ground surface, you can leave them.
Mm-hmm.
That's good for the tree.
As long as it's not a mulch volcano.
As long as it's not a mulch volcano. That'd be hard to do in a really big tree. But
what we're talking about is if you mulch up to where it looks like a volcano, that's stressful for the tree, isn't it? Because that will try to put roots out higher up.
Well, that absolutely kills the tree. What it does more than making it put roots out is that it allows insects and disease organisms a nice moist place to get established. Mulch volcanoes are almost invariably fatal to trees.
Okay.
Now, going back to Hank's question, the other thing to watch out for is soil compaction. Our soils are easily compacted. If for many decades people have been stomping on it and driving heavy lawn mowing tractors over it, that soil is going to be compacted. And there are things you can do about it. There's a couple of the arborists in town have a tool called an air knife that they can use to reduce the soil compaction.
Mm-hmm.
We have tools that we can use to assess whether a soil is compacted, but you can tell that yourself. If you take a sharp-pointed stick of some kind and stick it in the soil, if you can't easily push it down into the soil, your soil is probably compacted.
Wow. And that's kind of the natural work. Earthworms sit there, naturally aerate the soil. The clover you're talking about naturally fixes some nitrogen.
And mulch, if you put mulch, let's say you put a 5-foot ring of mulch around a tree,
mm-hmm.
and the soil there was fairly compacted. You go back in a couple of years and you'll find that the soil is no longer compacted because there are earthworms and other organisms that are moving up and down, kind of stirring that soil up, and they'll relieve the compaction by themselves. Mm-hmm. Mulch is a wonderful thing as long as you don't overdo it.
Do you prefer a particular kind of mulch?
No, except don't use cypress mulch because it's not sustainable. It's harvested in an unsustainable fashion. But,
okay.
And there are plenty of places around that have high quality mulch. You mentioned Landscape Corner. They're,
okay.
That's where I get my mulch.
Okay. There you go, Elaine. So we're talking about taking care of the trees. 3-foot ring is good for mulch around the base of a tree. Is that going to allow it to get...
Well, yeah. I mean, there are two things about the mulch. First of all, you really need enough mulch to keep lawnmowers away from the tree, especially if you have contractors doing the mowing because they're often not as careful as they ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
So a 3-foot ring will help, but larger if you can do it. And it doesn't mean you have to have only mulch. You can plant small shrubs. You can plant, Louis's better at this than I am. You can plant other stuff in there that will grow and be decorative and nice and even flower.
And again, from an ecology standpoint, kind of create a system of plants that enjoy the shade under the tree, but again, work with the tree, right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Okay. Tell you what, we're going to be back in just a moment here on News Talk 590 WVLK. I told you it goes fast. Trees. We are unfortunately rapidly running out of time with Dr. Tom Kimmerer, the author of Venerable Trees. But just because we're running out of radio time doesn't mean people can't get more information. How do they do that?
Well, there's a couple of ways. First of all, if you go to our website, venerabletrees.org, there's a lot of information we post there about stories and articles about trees in general and about venerable trees. There's a news page. That story I just told about white pine, there's a whole article on our site. If you want autographed copies of the book, you can order them off our website. But you can also get the book at Morris Bookshop and of course, Joseph Beth. We have a very active Facebook presence. So if you're on Facebook, like Venerable Trees, and keep in touch with us.
There you go. And that website, again, is venerabletrees.org.
Correct.
Outstanding. Now, we are going to go to the phone lines, but real quickly I'm going to ask you. We talked about Give me those five again, which are venerable trees in the bluegrass.
Now don't neglect the other trees. There are other great trees in the bluegrass, but the venerable tree species are bur oak, shumard oak, chinkapin oak, blue ash, and king nut.
Okay. Now, also, I want to ask you that when you're talking about plantings on horse farms and different places, short-lived, real disappointing trees that might seem flashy at first, what are some species that you really, give me your bottom five trees, what are the ones that you really hate?
Well, red maple, I consider a disease, not a tree, but...
that's harsh.
Rather than giving a list of trees, what I would say in general is on a lot of landscapes, including a lot of the horse farms, we are replacing 300 to 500 100-year-old trees, or trees that have the potential to live that long, with trees that will be lucky to live 50.
Wow.
And in the long run, that's not sustainable. You can dramatically reduce the cost of your landscape management if you plant a tree that's going to be there for hundreds of years.
So horse farm managers, listen to that.
Yeah, and not just horse farms, golf courses, churchyards, schoolyards. We have a vast amount of space where we could be planting long-lived trees.
Okay. And another thing, a project we didn't get to, but you can see it on venerabletrees.org, is Reforest the Bluegrass, which is a very important project. Let's go to the phone lines. Brian is on the line. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask your guest there. I live across the street from Veterans Park.
Yes,
and
sir.
Are you familiar? I know you probably are. That tree that's up there, right around the walking track. It's a big bur oak.
Yeah, the Veterans Oak. Not only am I familiar with that, but there's quite a large number of venerable trees in Veterans Park, and they are reproducing.
Oh, good.
In fact, you've got a chapter on the book about that tree.
Yeah, yeah. Veterans Park is a fantastic resource for this community.
Okay. All right, I've stopped a few times and read that plaque, and it's pretty amazing how big it is.
Now, we need to be careful with that tree. I'm a little concerned that because of all the bicycles and pedestrians around it, the soil's getting compacted, and we need to do some clearing around it because it's going to get shaded out by faster-growing trees. It needs some work, but that's a great tree.
Brian, I appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you for your call. We're going to go and talk to Larry. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. I'm from Eastern Kentucky, and back in the early 60s, there was what we would call a white walnut or a butternut tree.
Yes, sir.
And then within 2 years, they were all gone. Blight or something came in and basically wiped them out.
Yeah, butternut is one of the saddest stories of trees in North America. It has a canker disease called butternut canker. And it's been slowly spreading throughout North America. Nobody knows where the disease comes from. When I was in graduate school, it was getting established in Wisconsin, and it's now becoming increasingly rare to find a butternut or a white walnut. And unfortunately, there's a new disease insect combination called thousand cankers disease of walnut that's in all the states around us. It's not in Kentucky yet, but it's going to do some major damage to our walnut population, and that's the most valuable tree in Kentucky for timber.
Wow.
Yeah. So there won't be any possibility of those trees, getting an amenity to it and making a comeback?
Well, there's always hope. I still find some butternut trees. I have found a few with healed cankers. So there may be some butternuts out there that are resistant, but it'll take, centuries for them to come back.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay, I was just curious as to what happened to them all.
Thank you for calling, Larry.
I appreciate you coming. Do want to ask you, since we're talking about disease, the one, we've only got about a minute here, but the one that's really in the headlines, emerald ash borer.
Yeah.
And that's taking out the white ash. You're saying the blue ash has got a little bit of resistance.
We believe the blue ash is resistant. Now, Dave Leonard and I have been looking at blue ash throughout the bluegrass for the last few years since the insect arrived here. I have a column on my website or on another website I write to for that you can find on Venerable Trees called A Beautiful Green Beetle. And it is an absolutely gorgeous little insect.
Yeah.
But it kills ash trees.
I was going to say, Japanese beetle looks pretty sharp, but it's nasty.
So far, we haven't seen any damage to blue ash in the bluegrass. And in southern Michigan, where the emerald ash borer was first introduced to the port of Detroit, the vast majority of blue ash in southern Michigan have survived. whereas all the white and green ash are gone.
So you're telling me this thing is an invasive insect? Where did it originally come from?
It's Asian. It was brought in we have a huge number of invasive insects and diseases that were brought in on packing material from China,
The
insect was living inside this wood packing material and escaped. We have very lax inspection. We're so focused on keeping terrorists out that I would regard emerald ash borer as a terrorist.
That and the zebra mussel. Yes, sir.
Yes, although if you talk to Wendell Hogg, he's one of the world's experts on mussels. He lives here in Kentucky, Forest Service scientist. He says zebra mussel populations are declining.
Well, that's all good news.
Isn't that cool?
Dr. Tom Kimmerer, Venerable Trees, I appreciate it. I wish we had much more time, but you can go visit the site venerabletrees.org and get more information. Thank you for being in on this Saturday morning.